This week on Art on the Air features artist, activist, educator, and current curator, Lobesnik Center for the Arts, Whitney Bradshaw, and choreographer, stage director, event producer, and author, Lynn Knight, each sharing their unique arts journey. Our spotlights on Lobesnik Center for the Arts exhibit Women to the Front, Arts from Sarah M. and Michelle Vance Weddell Collection, opening June 30th.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. We'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Lobesnik Center for the Arts. She's the curator and taking care of all the things that you see on exhibit there. I would like to welcome back to Art in the Air, Whitney Bradshaw. Welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Thanks so much, Larry and Esther. Appreciate being invited on and being able to share all the exhibitions we have going on and events here at Lobesnik.
Happy to see you.
Let's go ahead and start off with your summer exhibit. It's called Women to the Front Artworks. And just tell us about that, the artists involved, and, you know, times and dates on that. And we have a whole bunch of other things going on at Lobesnik.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I am very excited about the summer show. I've been really enjoying working on it. It's called, as you said, Women to the Front, Artworks from the Sarah M. and Michelle Vance Waddell Collection. It's a really incredible collection of artworks that I've been able to work with. And they're Sarah and Michelle. They live in Cincinnati, Ohio, and they started a contemporary art collection in the 1990s, which is the same time that Kathleen Hanna, the front woman from the punk rock feminist band Bikini Kill, started the sort of Girls to the Front movement that she did, where she would come on stage and she would say, "All right, girls to the front," and it would be an invitation and a recognition by the men that they should move to the back and allow the women to take up more space and be on stage and be in front. And so I thought titling the show Women to the Front, because the collection started at the same time, would be really a beautiful tribute to the feminist movement in the 90s, and specifically to Kathleen Hanna. And so the show has this sort of same intention of like creating space for women artists to take up and really to allow them to be front of stage and front of mind. So the collection that you'll get to see will be, I think, about 59 women artists from the 70s all the way up to the, 2024. And you'll recognize a lot of the names. So there'll be a lot of early feminist artists, including Carolee Schneeman, Anna Mendieta, Louise Bourgeois, Barbara Kruger, Yoko Ono, Elizabeth Catlett, and then all the way up to contemporary artists like Micheline Thomas and Jenny Holzer and Zanelle Muholi, and then some like Midwestern artists like Carmen Vinat from Ohio. So because it's an Ohio collection, a lot of the work that Sarah has collected is from that area. So it's a very powerful Midwestern collection. They don't only collect art by women, but the majority of the collection is art by women that ranges in media from drawing and painting, sculpture, mixed media, neon works. So it'll be a really interesting range.
So as this travels, because I've seen, you know, other places have hosted this collection, when you took this on, do you get to kind of cherry pick what you want, or does it come as, you know, a package deal?
Yeah, no, she has shown, she had a show at the Dayton Art Institute 2 years ago, I think, or a year and a half ago. And then she had a show at the Wave Pool Contemporary Art Center in Cincinnati and a few other places. But I totally got to go through the collection of over 1,000 pieces and choose what I wanted to include in the show. So it's really exciting. It was so much fun. And so there'll be a little more than 70 pieces in the show by 59 different artists.
So is it going to, Whitney, is it going to encompass the main gallery, the Heinemann, and the upstairs gallery?
The whole will be covered with artwork from this collection. Yeah, it's really one of the most substantial, socially conscious art collections in this area. So it'll be great to see.
Yeah, it'll be
they
very
really
exciting.
Have supported and celebrated and elevated voices of women and queer artists and Black, Indigenous, people of color within the art world. So people who've traditionally been marginalized.
Well, in the last minute and a half, tell us just quickly a couple other things going on there before we wrap this one up.
Yeah, so we have some exciting news. We got a grant to launch Michigan City's first artist in residence program. And we got the grant from the Indiana Arts Commission. And we are going to be working for this first inaugural artist in residence. We'll be working with Bernard Williams here in Michigan City. And it'll start mid-June and run through August 31st. And he'll have a studio at 720 Franklin Street that people can come in and see the work and see his artist practice and even buy work if they want to. So it should be a really unique and exciting experience. And then we have our Over the Rainbow Art Bash, our annual Lubeznik Center for the Arts Gala on Saturday, June 28th.
Excellent.
So if people are interested in supporting the center, they should go online and get some tickets.
Quickly, dates and information about the show coming up, Women's to the Front.
Yeah, so Women to the Front, artworks from the Sarah M. and Michelle Vance Waddell collection, an extraordinary collection, because don't miss it. It's going to be on view June 30th through October 26th.
Well, and then your curated talk is July 19th at 11:30. Everybody should go to that.
Yeah, and also the night of the opening at 6 p.m., we are going to have a conversation, me and Sarah Vance Waddell, about the collection at the opening.
Well, thank you for coming on Art of the Year Spotlight, Whitney Bradshaw, and Women to the Front at Lubeznik Center for the Arts. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Can't wait. Yeah,
thank you. A pleasure.
Thank you both.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Lakeshore Public Media is brought to you by McCauley Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker.
This is Hannah Hammond-Hagman of Chesterton Art Center, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM and WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are happy to welcome Whitney Bradshaw to Art on the Air. Whitney is an artist, activist, educator, documentary film producer, and former social worker. Her work has been shown widely across the United States. In 2003, she was named one of New City Magazine's top 50 Chicago artists. Since 2018, she has been traveling across the U.S. with Outcry, a feminist social practice project. Both Whitney and Outcry are the subject of a documentary film titled Outcry. Currently, she is the curator at the Lubeznik Center for the Arts in Michigan City, Indiana. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Whitney. It's so nice seeing you this morning.
Thank you so much for that nice introduction, Esther. It's lovely to see you too.
Well,
I just wanted to add one thing, that the documentary title is actually Outcry, Alchemists of Rage.
Thank you. Thank
I'm putting that because we really wanted it to be a different title than the project.
Right. And,
Well,
we always like to start with our guests, their origin story. And so we'll ask you how you got from where you were to where you are now. Tell us all about Whitney.
All right. Well, I'll start. I was born in Ingalls Hospital in the south suburbs of Chicago. I grew up in Homewood. I went to Homewood Flossmoor High School. I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. And when I was young, I really got interested in art and photography because of two things. My mom was a picture lady. I don't know if you remember picture ladies, but that was a thing that we had in school when we were in elementary school. So a mother, or usually a mom, would volunteer to come in and bring in original artworks or copies of artworks and talk to students about the pieces. Well, my mom was the picture lady. And so I started to get interested in art through that as a young person. And additionally, my family, my mom's side of the family, is from Ohio, a small town in Ohio called Sunbury. And my grandfather owned the newspaper in that town. And my uncle was the photojournalist. And he had a dark room at the newspaper. So I spent a lot of time visiting family, hanging out in the dark room and at the news. So I was really interested early on in this idea of free speech, the way that the news can be used to share stories that maybe people wouldn't have heard otherwise, and also the magic of photography in a dark room where you have this latent image. You know, you put a piece of paper in this chemical mix and suddenly the image starts to appear. So for me, all that magic is one of the reasons that I became interested in photography. I asked for a camera when I was probably, I think I was sixth or seventh grade, and I got one of those Kodak 1000 cameras, those skinny cameras, you know, those long, slender, rectangular cameras.
Yeah.
And I started making pictures and always continued that while also spending a lot of my time in grade school and high school in art classes, drawing and painting, and art was always one of my favorite things.
So Whitney, was photography part of your high school curriculum, or was that just when you were visiting relatives?
I never took photography in high school.
Wow.
No, I took art classes. I played the violin for 8 years and I danced ballet. My mom was a professional ballerina. And so she got me into ballet at a really young age. So I was really trying a lot of things out, just trying to see where I would wind up. And then I got really interested in social justice issues because where I grew up in Homewood, was a primarily white community. And then in the 70s and 80s, Black and brown families started to move into the community. And there was a lot of white flight happening. And I was really upset by this. I mean, our neighbors would come over and play cards with my parents. And the way our house was set up, you could kind of hear everything. There was no secrets. I mean, there were, but yeah, but there weren't
within the family.
And so I would overhear them talking about how they're planning to move out because so many Black families and brown families were moving in. And I found it really upsetting. And I was sort of the neighborhood babysitter. And when Black and brown families in the neighborhood started needing babysitters, I ended up babysitting for them. And my family stayed. My mom still lives in the same neighborhood, which now is much more diverse than it was. And I was really I think I really got a great education from spending time with people who were from different backgrounds than me. I learned a lot about the Latino families that I babysat for and their culture. And I learned a lot about the Black families and the families that were, you know, biracial that I was working with. And then that sort of changed a lot of my worldview. And I really became a young activist. And so when I was in high school, I was interested in those ideas. And then when I got to college, I really was able to spend time learning about the power structures in our culture and in our society. I ended up studying sociology and getting a master's in sociology. And I spearheaded the women's studies department at the university that I went to. There, it didn't exist. This was in 87, 88. And so me and one of my good friends who had taken a women in literature class, we approached our professor and said, we really think we should have a women's studies program on this campus. And she was all super supportive of it. And she was like, well, you two go and you, you know, meet with teachers and find out what professors want to teach women's studies courses. And so we developed a whole interdisciplinary women's studies curriculum. And I was the first to graduate with a degree in it.
Wow. So what was your first kind of social justice issue that grabbed you that you wanted to take further than the idea, maybe?
Well, I think that the thing that I really was like hitting the pavement for,
yeah,
gender equality, women's issues, equal rights, safety in the streets. For I am a sexual assault survivor from a young age, and I really took that on hardcore, and that was one of the things that really inspired me to want to have a women's studies curriculum, so we could have spaces for connection and support for young girls and women who have been through these things.
Right. Speaking it out loud is the hardest first step.
Yeah. Yeah. Just talking about it, because there's so much, our culture really silences those of us who've had that happen. And that silence works to support the perpetrators. So I've dedicated a lot of my life to that. Yeah. But additionally, have always done a lot of work around race and equity and inclusion wherever I've gone. And so I can talk a little bit more about that too. I don't know if you want to.
And we'll explore how you get connected, your work with photography. But I'm interested in your feelings on the whole pushback on DEI, which to me, I just do not understand. But, you know, that has really got to rile you up. It's like, it's such a, I don't know. But tell us about your reaction to this whole new pushback of that.
Well, I think it's absolutely insane. And I think that it's a way for, you know, right-wing white men in this country who've been able to benefit from having a lot of power and a lot of money and a lot of control. It's a way for them to you know, really try to make sure they don't lose that in some regard. And I mean, it's horrendous. It's really, to me, I think it's actually evil at its core and very, you know, fascist. So yeah, I'm really angry about it.
Yeah, I heard one way to talk, kind of push back on it is it's easy to you know, take like the initials DEI and just put that together and lump it, and then they make that a negative thing. But then when you need to break it apart for people that are talking, well, what do you have against diversity? What do you have, and take it and what do you have against inclusion? Do you want to be exclusionary? You know, and sometimes when you explain people what DEI is, they just hear it as a buzzword, and oh yeah, I'm against DEI. Well, do you know what it really means? They don't. You know, that's part of it.
Agreed. And I think it's another way of, you know, it's all about language and it's about propaganda. And, you know, I think one of the things that we're starting to see with this is, you know, that so many people when all of these efforts are illegal, you know, all of Trump's, you know, his efforts are, have been illegal, that, you know, people have, without really thinking through what they're doing, they have already started to dial those things back. Like we've seen that with Target, for example.
Right.
You know, they dialed it back and then everybody boycotts Target and they lose all their money. And so I think what we're seeing is that people really need to resist these things and fight against them and continue their diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, regardless of what, you know, the Fuhrer is saying.
Well, I'd like to now kind of move into your photography. How did photography, now you had your early experiences witnessing and working with photography and everything. So how did that come in to start informing your work and also obviously with seeing your work in social justice issues?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, like I said, I studied sociology and women's studies, and I continued to study art while I was in undergraduate school, too, but not in a studio practice. Instead, I was studying the history of film, and, you know, I was studying jazz, and I was studying all these other things that I'm very interested in and remain interested in. And I was continuing to take pictures, but I really never considered myself an artist or really embrace that as like where, what I was going to do. I had, as since a young person, I always wanted to be an artist, but I think that I was interested in so many things that I really wanted to experience a lot of the world and kind of, you know, make sure that the things that I thought were true and real in this world really are. And so that's one of my things with sociology. But then when I got out of school, and I ended up doing social services and eventually getting into social work. One of the jobs that I had was working with sexual assault survivors in emergency rooms in the city of Chicago. So I was on call for 14 hospitals. And anytime somebody was assaulted, whether it was a man, a woman, or a child, I would go to the emergency room and be their support person. And I would see them through rape kits. I would support them in conversations with the police and with the medical professionals. Sometimes I would go to lineups at the police department. Sometimes I would go back to the scene of the crime with the investigators and the survivor. Sometimes I would just change locks on people's doors because their, you know, keys and wallets and things were stolen. So anyway, to do that work, I had a very long intensive training that I went through. And in that training program, that was really what allowed me to become a social worker, was going through that whole process. I never got a master's degree in social work. So I kind of came into it through the back door. And similarly, I came into photography in a way like that, where while I was doing social service work and social work for about 8 years in the city, I was making pictures all the time. And I started, I paid $30, I think it was $30 a year, if I'm not mistaken, to use the wet darkroom at the Park District in the city. And so I would go and I learned how to make pictures in the darkroom. And then I would just do that every Friday night after working all week. I would go develop film. And then I would, you know, print over the weekend. And that was kind of the thing that I did. And then I started exhibiting my work at like cafes and stuff, at the Blind Faith Cafe and, you know, the few other cafes in the city. And then after I did social work for 8 years, I really was like, I needed to go do something for myself. You know, I felt like I needed to take care of myself a little bit. So I ended up applying to graduate school with the portfolio I had created over the last 8 years of work, which ended up being mostly images of young girls and women and very feminist in orientation, and a lot of photograms using advertisements and things like that. And So I ended up getting into grad school. I only applied to one school, Columbia College, Chicago. They had a great photo master's MFA program that was a 3-year program. And I kind of couldn't believe it, but I was so excited. And so I completely changed my career trajectory. But while I was in grad school, I really, through experimenting and making pictures and trying to figure out what I wanted to make work about, I realized that I could incorporate my social work interests into my art practice, and that photography was kind of the perfect medium for that, because it allowed me to make portraits of people, right? And work in collaboration with people. So I always think of portraiture as a collaborative endeavor. Right. You know, you're negotiating between you and the subject, and who gets the power and control over that is something that I'm always thinking about.
And it's very similar to what you were doing in social work, being a witness and a support for who you're with.
Exactly. So trying to create space to empower people to use their voices and speak up and out for themselves, or create space for healing, individual healing. So the project that led me to the outcry work that I've been doing was that a friend of mine was in a fire, and she and a bunch of other people were there, and they all survived, but she was very badly burned, and spent a lot of time in the burn ward at Cook County. And I was visiting her while she was there, and I was rubbing salve on her scars and spending time with her. And I started to really think of her scars as signs of resilience and as kind of beauty and power. And, you know,
survival.
She really is amazing. So, you know, I started to eventually, I didn't do this right away, but once she started she was a lot, you know, healed and back into the world. I was in grad school and I asked her if I could start photographing her scars. And she said yes. And so I started making pictures of her. And it took me a while to figure out how I was going to make them. And eventually I started making pictures that were very close up macro images of her skin, her, you know, burned skin that looked like craters or, you know, planets, surfaces, or the moon surface. And right. I started lighting them with
starbursts.
And I started lighting them with these crazy flashlights, like, you know, taped to a baseball cap. And I was like really close up. And then I started exhibiting those. And while I was exhibiting them and continued to make work pictures of her, I started to see a huge change in the way that she walked around in the world. And she had been covering her scars with scarves and not wearing tank tops. And eventually, through the process of making the pictures, she started to see her own scars as signs of resilience and beauty and even power, and even thinking of them as sexy. And so she started taking her scarves off and wearing tank tops. And then as I exhibited the pictures, people would come up to me at exhibition openings and say, "Hey, you know, my brother-in-law experienced this motorcycle accident." And, you know, so I ended up connecting with a lot of other people who had traumatic experiences that you could see on their skin. Right. And I ended up working with 9 people over the course of 3 years on the scar project.
You know, I have a question about outcry. Mm-hmm. Did you ever encounter anyone who initially could not scream?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The project is a really hard project to do. Yeah. And the sessions are 2 hours long. And I purposefully bring together people who are strangers. So you walk into a space, you don't know anybody. You might have one friend with you, but you can't bring a whole group of people. is intentionally, you're supposed to spend time with people you don't know from different walks of life so that we can create a space of radical empathy. But yeah, so there's a number of times where everybody's nervous, you know, and we practice, we talk about why I chose screaming. And then, you know, there was, I'll give you an example. There was one woman who was in her 70s, actually here in Michigan City. I did a scream session during the pandemic. I had a show here at Lubesnik. And she really, everybody gets three chances to scream, and I go around the whole group. And this woman was like passing every time. And then eventually I said, you know, is this something you really want to try? If you do, I'm here to support you in any way possible. And she said, yes, I really want to. And so I said, well, why don't you just turn your back to the camera? Don't even look at the camera and try that and see if that'll work. And so she did. She started backwards and she started, you know, very quietly screaming. And then she got louder and louder and started turning around towards the camera. And I ended up photographing her turning around with this huge scream. And she was in her 70s. And she afterwards said, I can't believe it's taken me this long to do this. And then she reached out to me later and told me that she was doing improv and everything now.
Oh my gosh.
Beat her up and opened up a whole new world for her.
It's so interesting, the people who have their eyes open and the people who have their eyes closed. I mean, it's just very...
Well, Whitney, we're almost out of time. Is there anything coming up in the last moments here, like about 30 seconds? We know about Lubesnik because we just heard it in the spotlight earlier, but anything else coming up in the next couple of moments?
Well, I could say that the Outcry Alchemists of Rage documentary is continuing to travel. We're trying to get it streaming. And there's a big Outcry exhibition opening in Louisville, Kentucky for a photography biennale there, and it'll be open the beginning of September through the end of December. So if you find yourself in Louisville, go to the 21C in Louisville, Kentucky, the 21C Museum Hotel.
Which I've stayed at, so it was beautiful.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
That's Whitney Bradshaw, and you can find out more about her at whitneybradshaw.com, and also you can get in touch with her at the Lubesnik Center for Arts, where she is the curator. Thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
So much.
Hi, this is Morgan McCabe, freelance theater professional and writer for the Northwest Indiana Times. You are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM. Thanks for listening.
We would like to welcome Lynn Knight to Art on the Air. Lynn is a dancer, dance teacher, studio owner, a theater choreographer and director, event producer, and author of dance books for children. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Lynn. It's very nice meeting you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. This is going to be a lot of fun.
We've never worked together, but we seem to have mutual friends in theater and everything like that for years, so we've touched around each other. But anyway, it's great to have you on the show and talk about your kind of storied career. And how we started off is talk about your origin story, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Lynn.
Well, I definitely took the wrong way. The long way, not the wrong way, the long way. It was absolutely the right way, but I just had a couple of detours. You know, going way back, my mom was a jazz musician. And then after several years of that, she turned to her church and was a musician, played for her church for over 40 years. So
what was her instrument?
She was a piano. She went to, I believe it was the University of Illinois for her music degree. And so she was a piano player. And she went for that. Then I think she played maybe 40 years in her church. And then my father was not a musician, but he and the whole side of my family were professional wrestlers. Mm-hmm. And that is a whole completely different life and a different story. So I really have a colorful
family. So tell it. Tell us what the household was like.
Well, in my parents, they divorced. You know, I was probably 9 years old, but in the early years, you know, they were all music lovers and I was all around music. And my uncles and my cousins, they were all athletes along with my father. And then, you know, I really don't know why the split. I can imagine, but my parents split and my father and went into the wrestling business with my uncles and my cousins. And my mother stayed with her music. So that's kind of a background. And she would insist that I would learn piano. And I had, you know, I was blessed with it, but it kind of turned on me a little bit. I had such an ear for music and musicality. She would give me piano lessons at a young age, and I didn't want to be bothered with it. You know, I'd rather go outside and roll around and do my acrobats. So I would mock what she would play for me. And then I would practice all week because that was fun. And then when I had my piano lesson, I would look at that sheet music and pretend I was reading music, and I really wasn't reading at all. So I did not learn that properly. And then when I got into
your rebellion, right?
When I got into the theater business, it kind of got back on me, because the first time I was handed a score for a play to do choreography for, now what? So I had to learn all over. But, you know, it was great having the mix. It was a good variety. You know, my father's side was all about the audience and screaming and yelling and excitement. And I thought that was exciting, too. So that, along with my music ability, kind of turned me into the dance life. I don't know how I got there, but it was a long story.
You know, wrestling is just its own form of ballet.
Entertainment, yeah.
It is. It's just the whole world of entertainment. And, you know, I was mesmerized by that. And, you know, about that time way back, Mary Martin's Peter Pan was out. And I fell in love with Tiger Lily and decided I was going to be like her. And that's why I became a dancer.
Wow. You know, we have a similar story. I know my mom was a musician and everything, so I had piano lessons, organ lessons, and what I would sometimes do, and it made my mom very aggravated, I would have my organ teacher or piano teacher play the thing first, and because I have, I think, a very good ear, I would play it that way. I could kind of still read music, and I did with my musical career, but like you, I was sort of one that said, you know, could you play that once for me? And then I would sort of then play it by ear more than I would read the music. I would look at the notes, but, you know, so you and I have a similar background with that.
That's exactly right. Did you get caught like I did?
Oh, yeah. My mom was at my lessons, and she would tell the teacher, don't let him do that. Make him read the music.
Oh, that's so true. It's, you know, we're really blessed to have, you know, that musicality inside of us. That's what makes us an artist in all forms. I don't think it matters what kind of an artist. It's a matter of what road we go down. But if you're an artist, you're an artist. And we're lucky. But sometimes you got to be careful. It can come back at you.
What do you mean?
Well, just like getting caught by not reading your music early enough. And then someone, you know, 25 years later, handing you a score in paper form and say, here, we're glad you're here to choreograph this musical. Well, then I was stuck. I had to hurry up and learn all over again, you know. And my children, I think, even though they all went down different paths, still they have natural artistic powers in them. I don't know what you want to call it, but, and they all ended up going down different roads, but I think it all stemmed from being artistic, you know, athletes and musicians. One's a musician, one's an athlete, one loves, you know, rock and roll trivia, you know, they just, growing up in that environment, especially with me, they had really no choice. But let me give you a shout out. I've had 4 children. Couldn't be more proud of all of them. My oldest son, Jeff, is he's got that amazing work ethic, you know, from the Midwest. He just recently retired. He's been in the mills for over 30 years and extremely devoted to his wife. But now he's enjoying his retirement and doing all the things he loves to do. So he, in his young life, of course I had him on stage in recitals. Of course I did. But, you know, he was an athlete and that didn't last long. You know, he had different thoughts. And my daughter, Janine, we lost her to a higher power several years back, but she was a gymnast. And she grew up in my dance studio, of course, and she went down the road of gymnastics. And then my young son, Michael, he is an extremely intelligent producer and director of several nationwide tours. And he's just a complete talented artist, you know, in my line of work. I couldn't be more happier with them than my grandson, Taylor. He's here in the Midwest. He's a brilliant surgeon and such a scholar. But, the other side of that, he is extremely interested and loves rock and roll trivia. You ask him anything and he could tell you. So, I kind of makes you wonder what he listens to, in the operating room. Right. And then my other grandson, Aaron, he's living in Southern Florida. Complete coincidence that the love of his life is a dance studio owner. I did not come for me. I have no idea how that ended up, but they're very happy. He was an athlete too, high school football player, college football player, 3 years of professional football in Europe. And you know what happens when love strikes, everything changes. But now he's an avid golfer and he's in the management business and really loves Southern Florida. I don't get to see him very often because of that.
Well, let's talk about you and your dance career. Sure. So how did that, take us, what happened after high school? So were you dancing?
After high school, I was trying to figure out, I came from a broken family, so I really didn't have the guidance, but trying to figure out, get a job. My mother always from the 50s, her goal in life was for me to find a husband and have children. That's her mindset where she grew up. And I knew that there was more to it. So I did some professional dancing, not for very long. I had a family at a young age. And I realized that it was going to take much more than being a professional dancer to be able to raise my family as a single mother. So that's when I went into teaching. I went into theater. I went into doing choreography because I knew I had to have a stable home. So actually, my first dance studio, I had a partner here locally there in the Portage Mall when it was still a Portage Mall. And my partner, I met someone, she was as passionate as me for dance. And we partnered and opened our very first dance studio in that Portage Mall. And we had a great time together. And that's what started it all. We were only together a couple of years, though. We artistically did not, blend real well. But when we split and went into our own dance studios, it wasn't enough to ruin our friendship. We are still friends to this day. And she's still in Portage. But I went to Valparaiso and opened my studio there. I was there for 18 years. What's the Lynn Knight Dance Center?
Okay.
And I was probably there 18 years, maybe. I ended up running a production company, doing shows overseas, having a competitive dance team and 30 years worth of judging dance competitions. I was really blessed that I was able to have my career and still be able to raise my family. So I was there for 18 years and then went to Merrillville Hobart and spent several more years. So that whole thing lasted about 35 years.
Wow.
I was in the dance studio.
So
business.
Lynn, was it primarily ballet or did it include that jazz background and maybe some modern contemporary?
All of it. It was a well-rounded studio. I was an all-around dance studio owner. And of course, it was much more popular to be a choreographer and a producer in the contemporary and jazz and tap genres as opposed to ballet. But of course, we always have to work on the ballet.
Right.
So it was an all-around thing. And I was able to travel all around from Russia. I did a couple in Japan. I did several in Aruba. So I was just very lucky to be able to travel all out and do that. And then, as my kids were then more grounded here in high school and such is when I came into Star Theater. and started choreographing and directing for them. I was there 11 years. I did several for them. So everything just kind of fell in place for me. And I just left very often, but I always came back. My children were grounded here. This is what they loved. And so I knew I had to be grounded, and this was my home base. Then everyone grew up and left me. I never came back.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Well, I was going to talk to you about your theatrical career. You touched on it briefly, but making the transition from being a pure dance slash choreographer and then moving into the genre of theater, talk about that. The other thing, too, and this is just another side thought, is the lifespan of a dancer in the performing arts is usually relatively short. I mean, very few people do a Cheetah Rivera and dancing well into their 60s the way she did. But yeah, why don't you hit those two subjects? You talk a little bit more about the transition from just being doing dance type things into actually storytelling with theatrical things.
Well, I knew when you have a dance studio that's very popular, and then you know you go into competitive dance, that really doesn't have to tell a story.
Right.
But I knew there was more, and I have always. That's why I went into more production, because I would always have a story to tell, depending on the subject that we were doing. And that was before I got into theater. And I always had that in my mind that you know, there has to be more to it. You have to dance with purpose at some point. And I try to share that with all my generations of dance students. You know, you can't just, you know, run to California and do a dance video and expect for that to be your life career. So I tried to share that in my dance studio as I went on and did more. And then someone contacted me, I believe. I have to really think back, but from the tour I did in the USSR, someone from STAR had known about that and invited me up to get into theater. Other than summer stock in Southern Florida, when I came into STAR, that was my first experience. And it ended up lasting for 11 years.
Yeah. Well, and I saw some of those productions, too. In fact, your last one was the Jesus Christ Superstar. I remember catching that one. That was one of the last theatrical shows that they put on there. So.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was the last one.
Yeah.
I think it was a year later when they went down. Broke my heart.
Yeah, it broke a lot of people's heart because it was the only large venue for different types of acts. And you know, there's talk of something to replace it, but right now nothing has really happened and everything. So do you have advice for someone starting a career in dance and like someone's coming along? And you probably have given this advice to people, what to do, what to study, what to pursue, and then, you know, later life in dancing, dancers tend to move into choreography and things. What kind of things can they prepare themselves for?
I try to teach all of my students to be a well-rounded performer, because dance has evolved. You know, before there was ballet and there was tap, you know, and there was all the different genres within dance, and you had your yearly dance recital. But now there are several roads that you can go down for dance. You can go to college, you can stay with competitive, you can be working in precision, you can be working in interpretive dance, you can go into musical theater. There's such a wide range now of dance options, which is a great thing. I love that so much, but I don't think they're all being traveled. You know, if you happen to be, I think, from a studio that is strictly competitive, and your goal is competitive dance, then you're going to go off to college, you're going to be a competitive dancer. And then after that, if that's the only training you've ever had, your choice is Rockettes or McDonald's. You know, so you have to be very careful. You have to be a well-rounded dancer. So any opportunity that comes along, you can grab it and you can say, hey, yes, I can do that. And I think it makes the dancer happier, too, because they have more options. And life after dance, life after being a dancer. Some people succeed and some people don't, but that's not the end of your dance career. We need dance studios. We need dance trainers. We need choreographers. We need musical theater experts. We need ballroom trainers. You know, there's so many options for teaching in your own studio or in the many, many places that need directors and choreographers. So that is my advice. I try to teach everyone to be prepared for everything. Don't have just one narrow path. And it seems to work. You know, I have a ton of professionals out there, you know, from dance to studio owners to producers, directors, you know, they're all out there. So I think it's very important to stress that.
Yeah, that's a nice legacy. So Lynn, is it my understanding that the books came about because of the pandemic? Is that when you started writing them? Could you talk about your books?
Surely did. I was in the pandemic. I happened to go and visit my young son, and he has a lot of land in Northern California. And a month after I arrived, the pandemic had hit. And so I was in the middle of wildlife during that pandemic, and he was an overbearing, wanted to trade places and become my father. I think he took such good care of me and isolated me. So, you know, there was nothing. It was like I was telling Larry earlier, my choices were be creative on the computer and do some writing or go out and teach the coyotes how to plié. Those were my choices. So I chose writing, and I just wanted to first tell a positive story and give a lot of options to real young babies. And then I went into educational writing for the young ones so they could understand dance terminology. So, you know, those two things turned into three volumes of learning my dance words and three other just fun-filled children's books. And I don't know. I'm not a writer. I don't know how I did it.
Who did the illustrations for you?
I did them. I did them all.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, I did. You could tell, I think. No, maybe not. I don't know. But it was, it kept me busy and it kept me occupied. And so then I decided to pursue that and do that. I've been doing that ever since, actually. Until most recently, I've started a nonprofit. I'm back in the studio. I'm not in my own studio, but I work a lot at the Lou Besnick Art Center and for them, for the basics of theater. I'm in a dance studio here in Chesterton, training the dance kids. And now I've started a nonprofit, Support Performing Arts, that we're trying to raise money to help young artists, you know, get the education they need. So that's keeping me pretty busy right now,
I would say.
Quite a legacy there. I was curious, way back, and I wanted to ask you this question. Have you ever appeared in roles on stage, whether in high school or, you know, in an actual or you seem to come to theater later in your life. So, but did you ever appear in a role?
No, I did not. I did a movie, NBC Movie of the Week. I came on as a choreographer and then ended up as an extra and then ended up, you know, at the spur of the moment as a choreographer to have a part in the movie that was in a bar on a dance floor. So that was pretty interesting. But I have always just been happy creating. My true love is to create, whether it's dance or theater or mentor young ones from two left feet to professionals. It just gives me a really good warm feeling to be able to create.
Yeah, it keeps your creative juices flowing. I'm retired from theater for like 41, did 41 years and some level all the way along, so I know the feeling. Well, in our last about minute here, tell us how people can find out, first of all, about you, but also your supportperformingarts.org, where they can find out information about that.
There's a website, supportperformingarts.org. You can go there, get all the information you need. We just recently launched. I'm very excited about it. We're getting ready to do some concerts as fundraisers and do some workshops and invite a lot of the kids and adults. There's an adult section as well. And to come in and get some extra training, which none of it costs anything. If you audition and you make it into the group, then everything, of course, is free. That's the purpose of the nonprofit. So we're just kind of out into music and theater and dance, and we're trying to just make it grow in our area.
That's great.
Oh, that's lovely.
Well, you can find that at supportperformingarts.org, and you can find out about that. Also, your books are available on Amazon, so if you want to pick up some interesting books that Lynn has not only done the illustrations, but writing is a great way to introduction to dance and just kind of a feel-good. Lynn, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air. It's been very special for me to finally connect with you directly. We've always kind of circled in the same universe, but never been to that. So thank you for coming on the show and sharing your art and dance journey.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn.
Thank you.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operation for Lakeshore Public Media, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant, South Shore Arts, and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art in the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air, our way. Express yourself through and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world your heart. Express yourself through art. And show the world.